A large majority of Democratic caucusgoers think government should do something about income inequality. Most Republican caucusgoers do not. This hour, the partisan divides over the issues. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This Politics Wednesday, in large part devoted to the 2016 race for the White House, as candidates continue to visit our state and woo us Iowans. Marco Rubio and Hillary Clinton, to name a couple. Analysts Dennis Goldford and Rachel Caulfield of Drake University with us this hour. We'll also talk about what's being called the Bernie surge, and who will be left out of the first GOP debates. Also, redistricting before the U.S. Supreme Court. Join our discussion. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's Wednesday. That must mean we're up for an hour of politics. And indeed, we have great guests with us, analysts. Rachel Caulfield is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at Drake University, as well as Dennis Goldford, Professor of Political Science at Drake University. Both Dennis and Rachel in our Des Moines studio. Thank you for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure.
And we will have a number of things. And looking at the calendar, Dennis and Rachel, when we have a half year before the first in the nation caucuses, others on other planets, they say that's a long time. Here we've been talking about it for a while. I guess things are heating up. Can we say that? Even though it's just 6 months, there is a lot of activity, is what I'm trying to get around to saying there. And we want to talk about some of the activity within the last few days. Let's also include in the next few minutes, Dean Borg is with us. Hillary Clinton is in Iowa again, and Dean Borg has been covering her. Dean was at the Iowa City Public Library yesterday, where Hillary Clinton was speaking before an overflow crowd to be over 300, 350, Dean?
Yes, Ben, that the Hillary Clinton staffers came around and said we've counted about 350. So mm-hmm. I took their word for it, about 350. I counted myself somewhat less than that, but there were people standing and out the door and out on the street outside. So 350 would take it, yes.
What issues did Clinton come to talk about?
Well, Ben, a range of issues, but I had some observations, I thought, because I covered her on her first foray into Iowa up in Monticello. And I thought that this event, well, although it was differently staged, she was much more engaging, much more rapport, and personal interaction with the audience, standing, holding a portable microphone in a semicircle of about, as we said, 350 people. She remained after her maybe about 45-minute formal remarks, remained for another half hour answering questions from the audience, and then for another half hour after that with people standing around her taking photos and talking with them. Another observation, Ben, 2 to 3 times she mentioned Bill Clinton's presidential achievements specifically. So if anyone's wondering, are you going to hide from being another Clinton, she certainly is not that. And the thing that struck me, too, is that she'd been well briefed on local events. She tied the need for tighter gun control to a recent shooting at Coral Ridge Mall. She mentioned by name the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, and when she was mentioning medical research funding, and not anything from notes. These were all things that she had memorized. And then on immigration reform, the Mennonite pastor Max, who was recently deported, and she spoke a lot about that.
She had something to say also about the Iowa's Democratic Party?
Well, she said it in this way. She said, we took a hit, and I think she meant nationally because she was talking about the congressional elections, off-year elections, and we took a hit as Democrats. But then she specifically mentioned, I, in my campaign, intend to help rebuild the Iowa Democratic Party. And that echoes something that Congressman Dave Lobosak of the 2nd District, he lives also in Iowa City. He wasn't there yesterday, but he had mentioned last week, too, he's taking a leadership role in that very thing. And she said, a spirited, competitive campaign with all of you coming out, caucusing, caucusing for me, I hope, but caucusing, that will help rebuild the Iowa Democratic Party.
Okay. The big news connected with Hillary Clinton, too, that her competitor, chief competitor in the Democratic Party, Bernie Sanders, is getting a surge in the polls, both here in Iowa and in New Hampshire. She addressed that as well?
I don't remember that she herself, during her remarks there yesterday, mentioned the name Bernie Sanders, but she did refer to a competitive campaign, and she was asked, and a question from the audience did mention the others in the race, Bernie Sanders, James Webb, Martin O'Malley.
Okay.
And then she came back with, well, this a good competitive race is what I want because it will help rebuild the Iowa Democratic Party.
We have a little bit of audio. Let's listen to Hillary Clinton on that.
Well, I'm doing exactly what I want to do in Iowa. We've been in the campaign a little less than 3 months. It'll be 3 months on Sunday. And I am having the opportunity to meet with and listen to Iowans across the state and find out what's on their minds, find out what they're worried about, what they're hoping for. And I think that's the strongest base on which to build a good campaign heading toward the caucuses. I also think, look, you know, this is going to be competitive. It should be competitive. It's only the presidency of the United States we're talking about. So, you know, the more the better. Let's get everybody out there. Let's get everybody, you know, working hard, running their own campaigns, and then we'll leave it up to Iowa to decide what happens in February.
Okay. Hillary Clinton there at the Iowa City Public Library yesterday. Dean Borg, before we say goodbye, anything to add to that appearance as you covered it?
Well, fittingly, I guess, as we close, she also closed in this way. She said, "This is my last rodeo." And she said, I'm going to give it my all. I'm a fighter.
Okay. Dean Borg, thank you for joining us with observations covering the Hillary Clinton campaign yesterday in Iowa. Dennis and Rachel, you've heard that characterized. Seems to be something of a departure for Hillary Clinton. Dennis, in this campaign cycle, lingering. Bill Clinton loved to linger. Now Hillary Clinton doing that?
She's not a natural politician, certainly not the way Bill Clinton is. Of course, there are not many people who are natural politicians the way Bill Clinton is. And she's always had the problem that, rightly or wrongly, people perceive her as being in a bubble, being isolated, being disconnected from everyday ordinary people. And, of course, her comment about leaving the White House dead broke, even though she was earning six figures per speech after she left the Secretary of State's office, that didn't help her either. So she's got to do the kind of connecting to everyday ordinary people, of the folks who show up for Iowa caucuses and the thing that make the Iowa caucuses so valuable.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, that coverage, what do you think of Hillary Clinton's latest venture here into Iowa?
I think she learned something from the 08 campaign. She learned that she does have to do some retail campaigning. She does have to shake hands and she has to stick around and talk to people. What I find interesting is, you know, the rhetoric about wanting this to be a good competitive race. That is right now the very best message that she can possibly send out there. First of all, it's a way of recognizing her rivals without actually naming them and giving them increased visibility. But it's also a way to kind of deflect from the Republicans' frequent claim that this is a coronation for Hillary Clinton and that she believes and is operating as if she will automatically receive the Democratic nomination. So it's a way to kind of insert some humility into her talking points and reinforce the idea that she's in it to meet regular people. She's in it for the right reasons. And so, you know, I think strategically she's hitting the right note, whether or not it's going to, you know, it's going to ultimately persuade a lot of people into her camp who aren't already there. I think that remains to be seen.
Let's talk about what's being called the Bernie surge, Vermont liberal presidential candidate, drawing huge, largely white crowds in liberal cities, including here in Iowa. He's Bernie Sanders urging Democrats to move left. Break from this centrism that, I guess we could say, defined the Clinton era, the Bill Clinton era. He's shooting up in the polls, Dennis and Rachel, even though he entered this presidential race really as hardly on the radar, a long shot. What do you see going on, Dennis?
Well, I would say that in political parties generally, there's always a fight, at least in American political parties, between the purists and the pragmatists. The pragmatists simply want to win elections, and they'll stitch together any kind of coalition they can to achieve an electoral majority. The purists tend to be true believers, and you have this all over the Republican Party. Those are the folks to whom Ted Cruz is appealing. And as you said and as Rachel noted, Hillary Clinton's always been identified with, of course, Bill Clinton, that more centrist Democratic candidate, the old DLC, Democratic Leadership Council. And she's always been perceived as not really being that liberal, Republican rhetoric to the contrary notwithstanding. So there's a segment of the Democratic Party that really wants a strong liberal candidate. These are the folks to whom Howard Dean appealed in 2004. And if they didn't get Elizabeth Warren, and they're looking to Bernie Sanders. So in a sense, Sanders represents the Democratic id at the moment.
So do you see – let me put this to you, Rachel. You mentioned Howard Dean there, Dennis. Do you see Bernie Sanders going the way of Howard Dean, perhaps with or without a scream?
Well, let's hope with, because that's always more entertaining.
That was entertaining.
Yeehaw. I think Bernie Sanders right now is tapping into a sense in the Democratic Party that there are some issues that have been ignored. And there was some hope in 2008, I think, that Obama's election might push those issues forward. And these are, in particular, income inequality and the gap between the rich and the poor. And that hasn't appeared to be a significant hallmark of the Obama administration. And so, you know, I think a group of Democratic voters is really seeking to see those issues put front and center. Sanders does that for them. And the fact that at this point we're talking about a Bernie Sanders surge, I think, is A, remarkable. And it demonstrates that perhaps some of our partisan cleavages are not just happening on the right, but are also happening on the left. That there are distinct camps within the Democratic Party. And we know that, you know, on the whole, more people are identifying themselves as socially and economically liberal. So that impulse is certainly there. Politico had a line in a story. I was just joking with Dennis about it. It's never mind whether Sanders can crack 40% in any primary against Hillary Clinton. If Bernie Sanders can get up to 40%, and if you had told, I think, virtually anybody 2 or 3 months ago that Bernie Sanders was going to crack 40%, right, or was it going to even come close to that, was going to crack 10%, I think people would have been amazed.
Right. And Dennis Goldford, you've reminded us over the years so rightly that it's not a matter of if you win the Iowa caucuses, it's a matter of expectations.
Absolutely.
Sure. And he's got the capacity, and I've said before, to embarrass her. That's what she's got to be concerned about. At the same time, and again, I think Rachel hit on this, she's got to have a competitive primary season because she's not run for anything in 7 years, and she's not a natural campaigner either. So, you know, you don't want to go play the Super Bowl without having played the main season, at least to get yourself warmed up and work out the kinks.
So in the Hillary Clinton campaign, are you worried or are you glad to have a worthy rival to toughen you up during this primary season so that you're ready and in shape for the general election?
If I were Hillary Clinton, I'd be glad to see him in the race. Mm-hmm. I would, you know, the sense that this is not inevitable, this is not a coronation, it will make you a stronger candidate. It will also make your campaign team sharper, more capable of response. It'll, I think, hone your skills out on the campaign trail, and that will ultimately be good for her.
The typical problem, and the Republicans face this as well, is when you have a nomination through competitive primaries, you've got to win that primary by beating and oftentimes attacking everybody else whose very support you will need in the general election.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking with political scientist Robert Putnam, Bob Putnam, tomorrow of the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, and he puts forward that opportunity gap linked to the income inequality is at a state that he thinks it will be the issue defining this election. I wonder if, and he backs up his case in his latest book by saying the income equality we have today goes back can only be likened to the Gilded Age and the age of robber barons. And then we had Teddy Roosevelt coming and busting the trusts early in the 20th century. Dennis, I wonder, with your historical perspective, could you see that happening this time around?
Well, it's there's a very interesting parallel, particularly in that you mentioned the Gilded Age. President Obama went to Osawatomie, what was it, a year or so ago, and gave a speech, and that's where Teddy Roosevelt gave his famous New Nationalism speech 100 years ago. And both Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, from slightly different perspectives during the Progressive Era, were concerned about individualism and individual opportunity in an era of giant trusts and huge concentrations of economic power. Now, the thing that the Democrats have to be careful about is that President Obama talked about income inequality. And to a great extent, that doesn't resonate always with Americans generally. What Teddy Roosevelt and his folks 100 years ago talked about was, and you adverted to it, Ben, was inequality of opportunity. And Americans tend to think, you know, just give me a shot, give me a time at bat, don't hand me anything, and let me show you what I can do. And that tends to resonate more generally with Americans, at least more centrist Americans, than income inequality does.
Mm-hmm. Let me share with listeners, I'm sure both of you have looked at the latest Quinnipiac poll, a number of issues, looking at likely Republican caucus goers, also likely Democratic caucus goers here in Iowa, and from income inequality to the Islamic State, Iowa's Democrats and Republicans are split on how the next president should tackle some of our country's most pressing concerns. This is a poll released Monday by Quinnipiac University, specifically on the income gap. Likely Republican caucus participants say 70% to 25%, a large majority of Republican caucus participants say that the federal government should not undertake efforts to reduce the income gap between wealthy Americans and the rest of the population. By comparison, 91% to 6% of Democrats say the government should take measures to reduce inequality. Rachel, what do you see in that number?
Well, I think clearly there's a partisan divide.
there's a huge partisan divide.
To state the obvious.
Is it the wording federal government that would trouble a conservative, right?
Well, I think part of it is federal government. I think part of it as well is simply an understanding of how the different parties think about and talk about these issues. And I think Dennis is exactly right to point out that, you know, there are kind of three related terms here. One is the income gap. One is the wealth gap, which has been growing. It has grown profoundly over the past several decades. And one is the opportunity gap. And so when you put all of those things together, you know, I think what you're doing is you're seeing people lump a lot of ideas into a single, a single metric or a single way of understanding it. And the way the question is worded may have something to do with those results. But on the whole, I think what you're seeing in those results is why Bernie Sanders is doing well on the campaign trail.
Mm-hmm. There's a key difference, I think, between the two sides in that if you make your premise the idea that the free market operates the way it's supposed to and there's no cheating, there's no discrimination, there's no unfair advantage, then of course, because of different amounts of achievement and effort, you're going to get unequal results. And for people who have that set of premises, that's quite fine. And Republicans tend to have that view. On the Democratic side, there tends to be more often the premise that the free market does not operate the way it's supposed to. There is discrimination. There is sometimes a jiggling with the rules. And therefore, the inequality is not the result of individual effort and achievement. It's the result of somebody having an unfair advantage.
Mm-hmm. In this Quinnipiac poll released on Monday, also immigration was the subject of some of the questioning here. 46% of likely GOP caucus goers in our state said that immigrants in the country illegally should be required to leave, 34% saying they should stay with a path to citizenship, 17% saying they should stay but no path to citizenship. Now, on the Democratic side, overwhelmingly, 83% saying illegal immigrants should be able to stay and apply for citizenship. Now, in the last few days, Hillary Clinton has been really bringing out a difference between her and Jeb Bush on this question of path to citizenship. Have you been following that, Dennis?
Yes, Bush is, you know, he started off the campaign even before he got in formally. He talked about sometimes it's better to lose the primary in order to win the general election. Of course, the problem is you get the nomination through the primaries. But Bush has more of a general election strategy, and his idea is that the only way Republicans can assemble a national presidential electoral vote majority in the country is to expand the base of the party. You can't rest with just the base. And so he wants to look to, and the Republican postmortem after the 2012 elections recommended that Republicans look to women and racial and ethnic minorities and young people, areas where constituencies Republicans don't speak to. So Bush is trying to nudge the party in that direction. However, the hardline Republican base, think Steve King, focuses on the idea of illegal immigration. The danger is that bleeds over into the very idea of immigration itself, legal or illegal. And they're much more skeptical of that.
Mm-hmm. So do you see Jeb Bush doing poorly in Iowa because of his immigration stance?
Well, it's not helping him. A couple of events I've gone to over the past year or two, when particularly Rick Perry from Texas has given his speech that if the federal government won't secure the borders, Texas will. And here we are in Iowa, nowhere near the southwestern border, but his response both times, last year and this year in the two events, was rapturous and tremendously enthusiastic on the part of Iowa Republicans.
Your thoughts on immigration as an issue, Rachel Caulfield, in Iowa?
Well, I think a lot of people kind of assume that immigration in Iowa is a purely ideological issue. And for a lot of communities across the state, it's not a purely ideological issue. It's an issue that's happening in their community every day. And so their personal experiences are defining the way that they understand immigration, the way that they think about immigration, and the people who are immigrating. And so, you know, based upon that, I think that there's room for Bush or for any candidate to have those kinds of conversations. I think they have to be aware of kind of what the underlying currents and contexts are for a lot of these rural towns in Iowa, and take the time to get to know the issue of immigration, not just on a national level, but also on a state level.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, before we have to take a break, immigration, income gap. So the economy, both of those issues tied to the economy, obviously. So this, unlike other elections about jobs, even though our unemployment rate has been dropping, Dennis?
The unemployment rate has been dropping statistically, but I think you have to go ask how everyday people are still experiencing the economy. And a lot of folks would probably say that things are still pretty tough. It's not tough here in Iowa the way it was in the mid-'80s when you had the farm crisis. But there's just been the sense that the economy is just sputtering back, at least on the part of a lot of people. We've lost manufacturing jobs, and a lot of folks want to see a lot more happening.
Okay, Dennis Goldford, stay with us in our Des Moines studio of Drake University, along with Rachel Caulfield, and it's Politics Wednesday. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about immigration and I guess you'd call it the wrench, perhaps. Donald Trump wouldn't call it a wrench that he's thrown in the Republican Party because of his immigration comments. We'll talk about how the GOP candidates have been reacting to that, and we'll hear that comment when we come back. We'll reach out to you on this Politics Day. What are you hearing? What are you seeing that you like or don't like from 2016 presidential candidates? They're among us. They've been visiting Iowa. Perhaps you've been to an event to see one of the candidates. Let us know about your reaction and what your issue is that will decide your vote, participation in the caucuses. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's Politics Day on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, where she's professor of political science, and Dennis Goldford is with us as well. Dennis, the professor at Drake University and a Flansburgh fellow with the Harkin Institute at Drake University. I want to mention that this Friday, Bob Putnam, the political scientist of Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government, a renowned political scientist, social scientist, will be a guest of Drake University, speaking to an event at Drake University's Harkin Institute. And he is a guest tomorrow on this program for the entire hour. He has a new book out called Our Kids, and he identifies in that book what we've been talking about this first half hour, in a political context, but he's talking about it in a different context, also politically, the widening opportunity gaps created by the growing inequality, income among Americans. Bob Putnam tomorrow on this program. Let's talk a little bit about immigration, specifically in connection with the GOP field, which I think, Dennis, Rachel, now up to 16. We're expecting Scott Walker to officially declare on Monday. He's been polling at the top here in Iowa as a fellow Midwesterner. But let's talk about Donald Trump, who declared it a couple weeks ago. And let's go back to one of his more notable pieces of speech. The real estate mogul, a reality TV star, announced his run for president. And he focused on the problems with Mexican immigrants and the problems they're bringing to the U.S. Let's have a listen to this.
The U.S. has become a dumping ground for everybody else's problems. Thank you. It's true. And these are the best and the finest. When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're not sending you. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people. But I speak to border guards, and they tell us what we're getting.
Okay, it was after these remarks a few days ago that companies like Macy's, NBC Universal cut ties with Donald Trump. Some in the Republican Party as well are doing the same over the 4th of July weekend. Florida Governor Jeb Bush, GOP presidential candidate, told CBS News he thinks Trump's rhetoric is misguided.
We're going to win when we're hopeful and optimistic and big and broad rather than, you know, just angry all the time.
And former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, who ran for president in 2012, got only 1 in 4 Latino votes. He said, though, that these remarks hurt the GOP with Romney with Trump's comments.
So I think he made a severe error in saying what he did about Mexican Americans.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the Trump factor here, Dennis Goldford. How are you seeing that affecting the race? Is it sucking all the oxygen out of the air?
It's drawing attention away from the rest of the candidates, and even for those candidates, again, like Cruz and Huckabee, say, who seem to think that you don't really need to expand the base, you simply have to motivate them to come out to vote. Even for them, I think, although Cruz has said he understands what Trump's saying, it causes some difficulties because you don't want to alienate a huge community. Now, if there's 17 people in the country in a particular group, however defined, it doesn't matter much other than politeness issues if you alienate them. But if you're talking about millions and millions of people, some of whom are eligible to vote now, others aren't, but their children may well be eligible to vote, you risk alienating a huge community. The Republican Party of California used to be a very competitive statewide political party. And under Governor Pete Wilson back in the 80s, I think it was, they passed a particular proposition regarding immigration. Rachel may recall the details of it. But at that point, the Republican support among the Hispanic communities in California sank like a stone, and they've simply not been competitive on a statewide level. Mm-hmm. That's the fear among Republicans nationwide.
I think in an interview today, we had Donald Trump promising, of course, he's big on promises, that if he would become the Republican nominee, he would win the Latino vote. Rachel Caulfield.
Well, there's no way he can possibly promise that. There's no way he can promise much of anything at this point. This is a guy who is very accustomed to paving his own path and doing his own thing, and he has the money and the fame to do it. He's dealing now with a totally different ballgame where his fate is not up to him. His fate is up to the voters, and those voters all across the country, including in Iowa and especially in Iowa. But you can go out and say anything that you want. He's demonstrating that adequately, I would say.
And you can say it many times when you have $8 billion.
Right. Yeah. You can say anything you want, and you can say it as loudly as you want and as often as you want. I think at some point you begin to realize that there are ramifications when you're dealing with real live people.
Let's go to Joe, and calling in from Humboldt, listening to this program. Hello, Joe. You had a comment about Donald Trump's candidacy.
Thank you for taking my call. First of all, let's face it, Donald Trump is in the business of promoting Donald Trump. I don't think anybody seriously thinks he'll ever be president. Maybe they do, but this is what he does. And what I'm discouraged about is, you know, that my representative in Congress just backed Trump up completely and said, oh, yeah, you know, Steve King, I know. That's exactly what Mexicans are like. And he represents, and I wish people would start to realize, he represents Iowa. And while Steve King is building the Steve King brand to be just as ridiculous and out of control as Trump, this is the representative that we have that people think, oh, yeah, Iowa, Steve King, perfect.
All right.
You know? So,
Joe, that's your view. From Humboldt, Joe, thank you for your comment. Join our conversation. What are you seeing? What are you hearing that you like, that you don't like from 2016 presidential candidates? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Iowa Public Radio also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's talk about the GOP debates. They're a month or so away. 10 GOP candidates will be featured in an August 6th Fox News debate. This will be the first debate among 2016 candidates. Now, prior to that, the Fox News channel will average together the latest polls of the Republican field and determine which of the 10 of the 16 announced candidates will participate in this first debate. So there are 10 chairs, 16 candidates playing musical chairs, I guess. Dennis, how important is this debate for candidates? A lot of highs will be on that first debate.
You know, the standard problem is when you have a range of candidates, even it doesn't have to be as big as the Republican range is right now, but when you have a range of candidates that includes people who poll very low, the tendency is to say, well, don't put them on the stage. They'll be a distraction. They don't have a reasonable chance of winning. Their response is, but I don't have a reasonable chance of winning as long as you don't put me on the stage. If you put me on the stage, then, in fact, I can boost my chances. And you saw Rick Santorum say recently, look, I was in very low a range of polling, and I end up winning, he said, the caucuses in 2012. So Fox has created an interesting dynamic for itself. It's been subject to some criticism, certainly a lot from outsiders. Republicans are in a more sticky situation because they don't want to irritate Fox because Fox speaks to their constituencies.
Mm-hmm. Jeb Bush, Scott Walker, Marco Rubio, we're thinking would have solid spots on that debate platform. I suppose Donald Trump. Rachel, who else are you seeing? Who should be concerned?
Well, I think, quite frankly, the rest of the field should be concerned. The vicissitudes of polling are deeply problematic in this situation. There's no way of knowing which polls Fox will be taking into consideration in determining which candidates they'll put on the stage. When you have this many candidates, they will be separated inevitably. They will be separated by 1 or 2 percentage points. That's clearly within the margin of error of any poll. Even the best of poll is going to have error built into it. And so, you know, there's no way to distinguish between these candidates with a level of precision that I think Fox is assuming or hoping for. And so, you know, if I were Carly Fiorina, obviously I would be pinning a lot on the debates. Whether or not she's going to be able to get in, that's a huge challenge for her right now. And as Dennis indicated, you know, there's a cycle here, right? Once you're on the debate stage, then you have the opportunity to raise more money, then you have the opportunity to raise visibility. One of the things I think that we haven't explored very much about these debates are what it means for the current nominating process. These are national polls, and what that means is candidates essentially, in order to get on that debate stage, they have to be running a national campaign early in the cycle, before Iowa, before New Hampshire. And if you don't have the money and the national name recognition to do that, then your chances diminish very, very quickly. But I think as Iowans, we should probably be paying attention to the fact that essentially a national campaign is being run before Iowa ever votes.
Rachel Caulfield with us. So Dennis Goldford of Drake University. Let's include Larry on our conversation. Larry, listening in Coralville. Hi, Larry.
Hello. My question is, considering the ego of Donald Trump or the vast liberalism of Bernie Sanders, would Congress, considering the makeup presently, Would either one of those houses work with a President Trump or a President Sanders?
Okay, there's some imagination. Donald Trump as president, let's imagine it. Or Bernie Sanders as president. How would they work with Congress? Let's deal with that hypothetical.
I think there's also a question of whether or not a President Trump would work with Congress. I don't think he's accustomed to having a coordinate and equal branch of government pushing back against him.
Uh-huh. If a Republican Congress won't work with Barack Obama, it absolutely will not work with a President Bernie Sanders.
Okay. No. But in this Quinnipiac poll that we referred to earlier, here's something about it that discovered many issues. Majority of likely Republican participants in our caucuses, 68% to 28%, said that having experience in business makes a candidate better prepared for being president than working in government. Democrats responded in opposite fashion, 76% saying government experience is better. So whatever that's worth. Well, interesting comment from Larry in Coralville.
Yeah, I think some of those poll numbers actually go back to a point that Dennis made earlier, which is, if you are of the belief that the market rewards those who are doing things right, who are smart and who are capable, and that the market has a natural mechanism, then doing well in business indicates something about you, mm-hmm. And your success in business will necessarily, I think, make you a viable contender for any number of roles. And, so it's not a surprise, I don't think, that we see conservatives and Republican caucus goers more likely to invest in that idea.
The next significant development in the Republican presidential race coming on Monday, Scott Walker officially announcing his White House bid in Wisconsin. Oh, you're saying, I thought he already did. No, he hasn't.
Nope.
He's been polling at the top of the heap here in Iowa. Dennis, is he considered a front runner nationally? Yes, I suppose.
To the extent that being a front runner nationally means anything at this point. I mean, it's a nice place to be, but I wouldn't bet the house or even lunch on how long that might last. His breakout moment, as we've talked about before, was at Steve King's Freedom Summit in January. And he's a governor, which attracts more establishment Republicans, while at the same time he ticks the boxes for conservative evangelicals in regard to being a pastor's kid and growing up for a while in small-town Iowa and being anti-same-sex marriage, anti-abortion rights, and so forth. So he's considered somebody with some crossover appeal, but he seems to be, from all accounts, basing his whole campaign on being the Midwestern candidate. And he seems to be thinking that he can base a national candidacy successfully on being from the Midwest, which makes Iowa extremely important to him.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk in the closing minutes about a Supreme Court decision that was overshadowed by decisions by the Supreme Court on Obamacare and same-sex marriage of a couple weeks ago. Late last month, the Supreme Court ruled that Arizona's voters were entitled to try to make the process of drawing congressional district lines less partisan. And they wanted to do this by creating an independent redistricting commission. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, writing for this majority, the Supreme Court, it was a 5-4 decision, she endorsed what she called an endeavor by Arizona voters to address the problem of partisan gerrymandering, the drawing of legislative district lines to subordinate adherents of one political party and entrench a rival party in power. Those are the words of Justice Ginsburg. Now, the significance, Rachel, of this decision, because it has a bearing on Iowa. Iowa is in a very unique position as also having an independent redistricting commission.
Yeah, and Iowa is often held up as one of the very best redistricting processes in the country. We have an independent, nonpartisan redistricting process. And the legislature, once a map is produced, the legislature has a chance to reject that map. But the legislature does not draw district boundaries in Iowa. In Arizona, you had a slightly different situation in that this was a voter initiative, Proposition 106, that was passed in 2000. And the crux of the case came down to the Elections Clause of the Constitution, which says that the time, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. And so the critical question here is, what is a legislature? Which I think to a lot of people sounds overly simplistic, perhaps, and certainly to the dissent, to the authors of the dissent, it seemed overly simplistic. But essentially, what Ruth Bader Ginsburg said in her majority opinion was that the legislature does not simply include the formal institution of the state house and the state senate, but it includes the legislative power. And even though at the time of the Constitution the initiative process did not exist, it has come into existence, and it is a legislative power. It is a lawmaking power by the people of Arizona. And so if the people of Arizona choose to pass a law through the initiative process, and that law creates an independent redistricting commission, then that is the equivalent of a legislature.
Mm-hmm. So nobody likes gerrymandering.
Some people like gerrymandering very much.
Okay. You cut me to the quick. That's very, very good. Except I was wanting to say, of course, the politicians who benefit, who are in power. So, Dennis, let me put this to you. If Iowa is such a model, if this is upheld by the Supreme Court in Arizona's case, gerrymandering is bad. We agree on that. Why doesn't everybody try to take politics out of redistricting?
Because they benefit from it, the people who have the decision-making capacity, as Rachel indicated. There's an old line that supposedly the voters choose our politicians, but through redistricting and gerrymandering, the politicians choose their voters. They decide who they're going to represent. Now, remember, this has to do, when we talk at the federal level, only with the House of Representatives. There's no gerrymandering for the Senate because it's simply the whole state. And the fate of U.S. representatives, Dave Loebsack, Steve King, and so forth, lies in the hands with the state legislature and that particular process, whatever it may be. And you have there are various sorts of goals. You know, Democratic voters tend to be highly concentrated in urban areas. Republicans tend to be more spread out. So Republicans win more districts. They win more counties nationwide in presidential elections. But you had for quite a while Republicans tacitly working with African Americans to try to make sure you have more districts that will be represented by African Americans by gerrymandering more African Americans within a district. What this did was take those likely Democratic voters out of all sorts of other districts, and that helped Republicans. So sometimes the best of intentions, given your perspective, can blow up in your face.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if this Supreme Court decision narrowly in favor of creating this independent redistricting commission in Arizona offers any hope for those who want to change gerrymandering in other states. Do you think it has implications, Rachel Caulfield?
Well, the closest analogy in this case is California, where they have a similar process that has been put in place with an initiative. Seven other states use independent commissions like Iowa, but they have been passed through other means, so they're not simply hinging on the initiative process. And the legislature usually does have some role, as it does in Iowa. But I think one of the things that this does is it elevates the visibility of this process. There are a number of people who are very concerned about polarization in Congress and the declining number of swing districts. When you have secure incumbents who are serving in Congress, they have a propensity to be more partisan because they don't have to fear any sort of challenge from the other party in the next election. They only really fear a challenge from within their party. And so, therefore, they tend to go more to the left or more to the right in order to stave off a challenger within their own party. And that polarizes our members of Congress. So there's a pretty big push to consider redistricting as one way that we might diminish polarization and therefore produce a more productive Congress. Mm.
Let me leave you with this. I'm sure you picked this up in our news, so in our state in the last few days. We've been hearing certainly about South Carolina's efforts to remove that Confederate battle flag on its statehouse grounds. Well, Iowa Republicans have had to grapple with this controversy surrounding that old Dixie battle flag. and the debate it's fueled around its associations with slavery. Three Confederate flags flew from a truck pulling a Marion County Republicans parade float in the Independence Day parades this past weekend in Pleasantville and in Pella on Saturday. Harsh criticism from the party's state chairman and the resignation of two Marion County Central Committee members who owned the truck. I don't know if you had any comment besides this falls in the what were you thinking category, Dennis, Rachel? Should we leave it at that?
You took the words right out of my mouth.
The problem is my understanding of the history of this flag is that really the flag really didn't appear very much at all until desegregation started to occur in the 1950s and early 60s.
Right.
So it was used deliberately to symbol resistance to desegregation.
All right. Thank you very much. Always a joy to have you with us. Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Rachel Caulfield, also of Drake University. Thank you both for coming into our Des Moines studio.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth in Des Moines. Help from John Pemble. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow on the program, Bob Putnam. He's a great talker. Hope you'll tune in. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.